I'm very confident we also have a very fascinating and interesting afternoon. So, to start with, I have the pleasure to introduce Mr. Adriano Cunha, Deputy Attorney General of the Republic of Portugal, who will speak about Committee of Inquiries at Parliament as a continuation of what has started in the morning. Mr. Cunha, you have the floor. Thank you.
Boa tarde a todos. Um agradecimento à organização deste evento por me ter convidado a participar neste debate. A minha intervenção tem a ver com, e o título da intervenção é Inquéritos Parlamentares e Processos Criminais, uma relação nem sempre fácil e nem sempre bem compreendida. Espero que os tradutores, não dificulte muito a vida aos tradutores. Começando, explicitando o título da presente intervenção, é patente que no pós-25 de abril de 74, em Portugal, o relacionamento entre inquéritos parlamentares e processos criminais, o mesmo é dizer, entre comissões parlamentares de inquérito e tribunais ou autoridades judiciárias, nem sempre foi pacífica e clara. Hoje, à parte de certos detalhes que podem permanecer incertos, queremos que o fundamental da função e das competências próprias de cada um tenda a estar claramente definido. A nosso ver, tudo se clarifica na distinção das funções. As comissões parlamentares de inquérito, integrando-se no órgão de Estado que é o Parlamento, movem-se no âmbito das funções que constitucionalmente estão adstritas a este órgão pela Constituição. Assim, as suas funções podem variar entre a aquisição de informação, tendente a apoiar a função legislativa do Parlamento, ou a exercer a função de controlo do Governo e da Administração que a este cabe. Em qualquer caso, será sempre uma atividade desenvolvida, tendo como escopo e limite, diremos, as funções e competências outorgadas ao próprio Parlamento, por definição, funções políticas, de controle político ou de concretização legislativa. Os tribunais e as autoridades judiciárias exercem função jurisdicional ou contribuem para o seu exercício no sentido da definição das concretas situações jurídicas, penais, cíveis ou outras, que afetam as pessoas, singulares ou coletivas, as entidades públicas e o Estado, ou a comunidade em geral. Nestes termos, as comissões parlamentares de inquéritos não podem, assim como o Parlamento, exercer a função jurisdicional ou desenvolver qualquer atividade com esse desiderato em vista, sob pena de usurpação de funções. E os tribunais não podem, por sua vez, desenvolver função legislativa ou política ou atuar com esse escopo, sob pena também de usurpação de função. Se as coisas parecem assim, pelo menos em abstrato, relativamente simples, vale a pena analisar e tentar compreender as dúvidas que se colocaram pelo caminho da nossa evolução histórica, legislativa e jurisprudencial. É insufismável que na evolução histórica dos inquéritos parlamentares em Portugal nos últimos 40 anos teve papel decisivo a sucessão de inquéritos parlamentares ao chamado caso Camarate, tendentes a averiguar os motivos da queda da avionete que em dezembro de 1980 causou a morte do primeiro-ministro em exercício e respectiva comitiva. Parecendo ter-se instalado, então, a espaços, uma certa concorrência entre as comissões parlamentares e os tribunais para a averiguação e apuramento dos mesmos factos, para mais chegando a resultados aparentemente antagónicos, a fase mais aguda deste relacionamento, mas também a mais interessante analisar pelo que se verá, deu-se quando o Presidente da 5ª Comissão de Inquérito de Camarate solicitou ao juiz do Tribunal de Instrução Criminal de Lisboa o envio de dois relatórios periciais e outros elementos constantes do processo judicial, entretanto arquivado por falta de indícios da prática de ilícito criminal. O juiz negou o solicitado com fundamento de que a comissão parlamentar em causa se propunha, afinal, investigar a prática de um crime e identificar os seus responsáveis, em manifesta usurpação de funções que a Constituição reservava aos tribunais, assim invadindo o núcleo essencial da função jurisdicional, não prosseguindo qualquer das competências da Assembleia da República. E invocou a inconstitucionalidade das normas da Lei 593, que ainda é hoje o nosso regime jurídico dos inquéritos parlamentares, RGIP, que permitiam a constituição de comissões de inquérito parlamentar em sobreposição com processos judiciais em curso ou arquivados, como era ali o caso, pois aquela lei apenas previa a suspensão do inquérito parlamentar enquanto o processo judicial se encontrasse em curso e após a fase da pronúncia. O Tribunal Constitucional, no Acórdão 195 de 1994, veio contradizer este entendimento do juiz de instrução criminal, aclarando, em consonância, aliás, com a posição assumida pelo Ministério Público naquele recurso de fiscalização da constitucionalidade, que o objetivo das comissões de inquérito só pode consistir numa averiguação informal e global destinada a habilitar a Assembleia da República como órgão político e não, obviamente, como entidade jurisdicional, a adotar as medidas legislativa, política, de fiscalização, etc., situadas no âmbito da sua competência constitucional, que julgar adequadas. Não ocorre, pois, em consequência, qualquer partilha de funções jurisdicionais entre a Assembleia da República e os tribunais que possa constituir infração aos princípios constitucionais da independência do Poder Judicial e da reserva do juiz. Os fins prosseguidos pelos tribunais e pelas comissões de inquérito são distintos, uma vez que os primeiros visam determinar a responsabilidade jurídica, civil, penal ou administrativa, ao passo que as segundas apenas procuram apurar a responsabilidade política ou simplesmente realizar uma tarefa de informação para o Parlamento. Pelo exposto, resulta claramente que a atividade a desenvolver por aquela comissão é totalmente independente da atividade daquele tribunal e os resultados a que a mesma chegar não são vinculativos para o referido órgão da Administração da Justiça. É o próprio artigo 181, número 5 da Constituição, que hoje é o 178, número 5, que prevê o gozo por parte das comissões parlamentares de inquérito de poderes de investigação próprios das autoridades judiciais. No exercício dos poderes de investigação, podem as comissões parlamentares de inquérito recorrer a inspeções, perícias e prova testemunhal, bem como requisitar documentos, com observância, porém, dos limites decorrentes do processo penal em matéria de direitos de defesa dos arguidos. Os poderes de investigação das comissões parlamentares estão sujeitos a determinados limites, traduzidos uns no dever do respeito dos direitos fundamentais dos cidadãos e outros na proibição da prática de atos de instrução criminal. Por exemplo, revistas e buscas domiciliárias que só podem ter lugar mediante prévia autorização dos tribunais. Deve concluir-se que as normas da Lei 593, desaplicadas nas decisões recorridas, não violam os preceitos constitucionais invocados, nem qualquer outra norma ou princípio constitucional. Note-se que, não obstante o acórdão, contou com dois votos de vencido, de juízes constitucionais, que, embora reconhecendo a natureza substancialmente distinta da atuação dos tribunais e das comissões parlamentares, jurisdicional no primeiro caso, política no segundo, entenderam que o prosseguimento dos trabalhos da Comissão após o despacho de arquivamento do processo judicial era suscetível de ofender o caso julgado, instituto com relevância e proteção constitucional em matéria penal disciplinar ou de ilícito de mera ordenação social, tal como decorre do artigo 282, número 3 da Constituição. Seja como for, a partir desta deliberação do Tribunal Constitucional de 1994, provocada pelas comissões de inquérito ao caso Camarate, ficou mais clara a distinção entre as funções e os fins prosseguidos pelas comissões parlamentares de inquérito e pelos tribunais e autoridades judiciárias, daí sendo imperioso retirar as devidas consequências, designadamente quanto à livre possibilidade de existência e curso dos chamados inquéritos paralelos, inquéritos parlamentares e inquéritos judiciais. Estas consequências seriam retiradas pela alteração legislativa à Lei 593, levada a cabo em 1997, pela Lei 126-97, que veio, nomeadamente, terminar com a obrigatoriedade da suspensão dos inquéritos parlamentares durante a decorrência de processo judicial sobre os mesmos factos após a pronúncia. Agora, desde 1997, e considerando que as funções são distintas, como tinha dito o Tribunal Constitucional, uma eventual suspensão de um inquérito parlamentar passa a ser ponderada pelo próprio Parlamento. Por outro lado, e tal como já seria possível retirar da versão antecedente, ao menos a interpretação extensiva, como também reconhecera o acórdão do Tribunal Constitucional, a nova versão do número 2 do artigo 13º veio expressamente prever o direito das comissões de inquérito à coadjuvação das autoridades judiciárias, a par da coadjuvação dos órgãos de polícia criminal e das autoridades administrativas, já antes expressamente prevista. Por último, e precisamente porque a 6ª Comissão de Inquérito ao caso Camarate tinha visto insatisfeito o seu pedido de acesso a elementos judiciais com a invocação de segredo de justiça, tal como previsto no então número 6 do artigo 13º, também esta norma foi alterada, mais uma vez a reboque do caso Camarate, passando a dispor, com a alteração introduzida pela lei de 1997, que a recusa da apresentação de documentos ou de prestação de depoimento só se terá por justificada nos termos da lei processual penal. Podemos, pois, concluir que esta revisão da lei 593, em 1997, teve como objetivo introduzir-lhe alterações clarificadoras no sentido do entendimento estabelecido pelo Tribunal Constitucional no acórdão de 94, o qual não acolheu, corrigindo-a, a visão incorreta do juiz de instrução criminal do processo Camarate. Passo agora para na mesma página, para o número 4, para saltar um pouco. Vai ser no âmbito das iniciativas legislativas tendentes à alteração da Lei 593, na redação então estabelecida em 97, iniciativas que desembocariam na atual redação da Lei 593, introduzidas em 2007, que assistiremos ao surgimento de novas visões incorretas, em nossa opinião e sempre com o devido respeito por eventuais opiniões contrárias, quanto às naturezas e ao mútuo relacionamento dos inquéritos parlamentares e dos processos judiciais, ou, se preferir, das comissões parlamentares de inquérito e o Parlamento e os tribunais e as autoridades judiciárias, ainda que sem terem obtido vencimento afinal. A sua análise pode, no entanto, ser útil para nos ajudar a clarificar os termos da questão. Na verdade, então, estiveram então sobre a mesa duas previsões ou projetos de normas legislativas que traduziam, a nosso ver, um deficiente entendimento das questões. Numa delas, projetado artigo 20A, previa-se que o Parlamento pudesse transmitir ao Ministério Público a obrigatoriedade deste órgão deduzir acusação sempre que tivesse arquivado inquérito judicial contra indícios apurados pela Comissão Parlamentar de Inquérito, quer futura, quer pretérita, relativamente a crime de que tivesse resultado a morte do Presidente da República, do Presidente da Assembleia da República, do Primeiro-Ministro ou de outro membro do Governo em funções. Esta previsão legal foi rejeitada com fundamento em que, desde logo, constituiria uma intromissão intolerável na autonomia do Ministério Público. Noutra versão, também projetada para o mesmo artigo 20A, bem mais interessante e útil para a nossa clarificação, previa-se que, nos casos referidos, e pressupondo também a não acusação por parte do Ministério Público, a Assembleia da República se pudesse constituir assistente no processo judicial penal representada por advogado. Esta última versão, que acabaria também por não vingar, teve, à altura, apoiantes e opositores, quer ao nível dos deputados, quer no que toca a comentadores doutrinários. Os opositores argumentaram que se tratava de uma ingerência na autonomia do Ministério Público e, em termos mais gerais, que se tratava de uma ingerência do poder político na esfera judiciária, erigindo-se o mandatário do Parlamento, o advogado do Parlamento, como um verdadeiro procurador especial ad hoc. Os apoiantes deste projeto, por seu turno, argumentaram que não haveria qualquer ingerência na autonomia do Ministério Público ou na esfera judiciária, pois que a figura do assistente no processo penal é perfeitamente legítima, usual e perfeitamente conforme ao modelo acusatório do processo penal português. Parece-nos, porém, que a questão nestes termos esteve mal colocada. Com efeito, a previsão da figura do assistente no processo penal português é comum e nada choca com a autonomia do Ministério Público nem com o modelo acusatório. Não é, pois, aqui que a crítica é pertinente. O que nos parece chocar com aquele projeto normativo é a natureza das funções e dos fins que as comissões parlamentares de inquérito prosseguem e o Parlamento através da atividade daquelas. Como a doutrina tem referido, bem como o Tribunal Constitucional, as comissões parlamentares, ao desenvolverem inquéritos parlamentares, movem-se no âmbito das funções e finalidades do órgão Parlamento. Como já se disse, funções de recolha de informação para fins políticos, de controlo ou responsabilização ou para fins legislativos. A preocupação da aplicação da lei geral ao caso concreto, definindo situações jurídicas concretas, penais, cíveis, administrativas ou outras, constituindo função jurisdicional dos tribunais, é-lhe completamente alheia. E tem de lhe ser completamente alheia, como ao invés, totalmente alheia aos tribunais, deve ser a preocupação de exercer uma função política ou administrativa executiva. Daqui decorre que não é o facto de o Parlamento poder constituir-se assistente, como tal podendo deduzir a acusação, que está defeso. Aliás, na hipótese de ser o Parlamento vítima de um crime, por exemplo, de difamação a injúrias, de furto ou de dano, nada obsta a que se constitua assistente no processo criminal em causa e até que eventualmente deduza a acusação particular ou requeira a abertura de instrução acompanhado ou desacompanhado do Ministério Público. O que a nosso ver não pode é, no plano do exercício de uma função estritamente política, como é aquela que exerce através das comissões parlamentares de inquérito, ou com fundamento nela, intervir ou interferir diretamente, por qualquer modo, nos processos judiciais e na função jurisdicional, sob pena de atuar em desvio de poder ou de funções. Confirmando esta clarificação de competências e funções distintas entre as comissões parlamentares de inquérito e os tribunais, designadamente no que toca a processos criminais, reveste-se de grande interesse uma recente decisão do Tribunal Europeu dos Direitos Humanos, acórdão Rivin contra Polónia, número 64/2016, de 18/2/2016, queixa 6091/06. Já agora faço um comentário à latre que não posso. Aliás, não faço comentário nenhum, mas apenas uma nota. Esta queixa entrou no dia 1 de fevereiro de 2006, foi julgada no dia 18 de fevereiro de 2016, portanto, mais de 10 anos, no comments. Onde estava em causa, uma queixa de um cidadão polaco, conhecido produtor de cinema local, por se ter visto envolvido numa comissão de inquérito da Dieta, Câmara Baixa do Parlamento Polaco, acusado como agente de tentativa de corrupção no processo legislativo de alteração da lei do audiovisual. E logo de seguida, arguído pelos mesmos factos, em inquérito judicial criminal que decorreu paralelamente aos trabalhos da comissão de inquérito. Afinal, acabou por ser referenciado no relatório final do inquérito parlamentar como corruptor e depois condenado no processo judicial criminal. Queixou-se ao Tribunal Europeu dos Direitos Humanos de que a comissão queixou-se de várias coisas, mas...
Sorry, this case will be presented by the Polish colleague later on, okay. So maybe you can...
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, okay. Mas vou só resumindo, portanto, penso que não faz mal, queixando-se de que a Comissão Parlamentar havia violado o seu direito à presunção de inocência. Uma das queixas era ter violado a presunção de inocência. E, segunda queixa, que por via do inquérito parlamentar e do alarido público que acompanhara os seus trabalhos e dos termos do relatório final, não tivera direito a um processo judicial equitativo em que viera a ser condenado. O Tribunal negou ambas as queixas, estas duas queixas. Não vou comentar, mas certamente a colega depois dirá. O que há de muito importante neste acórdão, que é um acórdão recente, do ano passado, é que tem um parecer da Comissão de Veneza, precisamente sobre as questões da separação de funções, competências, objetivos entre as comissões parlamentares de inquérito e os tribunais, os processos judiciais. E, portanto, é toda uma doutrina que está, através deste parecer da Comissão de Veneza, adotado neste acórdão do Tribunal Europeu dos Direitos Humanos. Portanto, vou saltar todas estas observações da Comissão de Veneza, mas chamando a atenção, e que será também com certeza comentado, da grande importância deste acórdão e deste parecer da Comissão de Veneza sobre esta matéria. Depois desta análise clarificadora quanto às distintas natureza, competências, funções e objetivos, gostaria de listar ainda algumas notas breves e eventuais dúvidas quanto ao relacionamento entre as comissões parlamentares de inquérito e os tribunais. Como é sabido, nos termos do artigo 5º do regime jurídico português, o Presidente da Assembleia da República comunica ao Procurador-Geral da República o conteúdo da resolução ou a parte dispositiva do requerimento que determine a realização do inquérito, e o Procurador-Geral da República informa à Assembleia da República se, com base nos mesmos factos, se encontra em curso algum processo criminal e em que fase. Caso exista processo criminal em curso, cabe ao Parlamento deliberar sobre a eventual suspensão do processo de inquérito parlamentar até ao trânsito em julgado da correspondente sentença judicial. Como se referiu atrás, antes de 1997, a suspensão do inquérito parlamentar era obrigatória, encontrando-se em curso processo criminal sobre o mesmo objeto, desde a fase da pronúncia até ao trânsito em julgado da correspondente sentença judicial, nada impedindo, porém, o curso paralelo durante a fase da investigação criminal. Estas trocas de informação iniciais, previstas neste artigo 5º, têm sido cumpridas sem que tenham suscitado particulares dúvidas ou dificuldades. Já as normas constantes do artigo 13º, sobre os poderes das comissões parlamentares de inquérito, podem suscitar e têm suscitado algumas dúvidas ao longo dos tempos relativamente às suas sucessivas redações. Na sua versão original, o número 1 previa que as comissões parlamentares gozam de todos os poderes de investigação das autoridades judiciárias. Na revisão de 97, passou a constar que gozam de todos os poderes das autoridades judiciais. Para atualmente, a partir de 2007, passar a referir que gozam dos poderes de investigação das autoridades judiciais que a estas não estejam constitucionalmente reservadas. Por sua vez, recordemos que o número 5 do artigo 178 da Constituição determina que as comissões parlamentares de inquérito gozam de poderes de investigação próprios das autoridades judiciais. Como dizem Gomes Canetilho e Vital Moreira na sua Constituição anotada, não é transparente o sentido do número 5 sobre os poderes de investigação das comissões parlamentares de inquérito. Seguramente que os poderes das comissões de inquérito têm um limite naqueles direitos fundamentais dos cidadãos que mesmo a investigação criminal não podem ser afetados senão por decisão de um juiz. Por seu lado, nos números 2 e 3, passou a prever expressamente a partir de 97 que as comissões têm direito à coadjuvação também das autoridades judiciárias, quando até aí apenas se previa a coadjuvação dos órgãos de polícia criminal e das autoridades administrativas nos mesmos termos que os tribunais. E acrescentou-se também na mesma altura que as comissões podem solicitar informações e documentos às autoridades judiciais, quando até aí apenas se previa que solicitassem ao Governo, à administração, a entidades privadas. Por último, na versão original do número 6, atual número 7, previa-se que o fornecimento de documentos ou prestação de depoimentos só poderiam ser recusados com fundamento em segredo de Estado ou em segredo de Justiça. Atualmente, desde 97, tais recusas só se têm por justificado nos termos da lei processual penal. Diga-se que as recusas não justificadas de comparência, de prestação de depoimento ou não acatamento em geral de ordens legítimas de uma comissão parlamentar de inquérito no exercício das suas funções, constituem crime de desobediência qualificada previsto no artigo 19 do regime jurídico e punido nos termos do 348 do Código Penal, com pena de prisão até 2 anos ou de multa até 240 dias, devendo o Parlamento comunicar a ocorrência de tais factos para fins de procedimento criminal à Procuradoria-Geral da República. Na prática, estas comunicações têm sido bastante raras. Terminar apenas citizante perguntando, afinal, que poderes de investigação estão ao alcance das comissões de inquérito e de que direito à coadjuvação, designadamente os tribunais, gozam as comissões de inquérito. Ainda que, como foi referido, tal não seja totalmente transparente, pensamos que há a tal letra do número 1 do artigo 13º do regime jurídico, que expressa que gozam dos poderes de investigação das autoridades judiciais que a estas não estejam constitucionalmente reservadas, condiz substancialmente com a norma constitucional e indica que podem ser atuados todos os poderes de investigação, com exceção daqueles que, mesmo a investigação criminal, só podem sê-lo por decisão judicial. Revistas, buscas, apreensões, etc. Neste sentido, Nuno Pissarra, em Ciência Jurídica. E também, desde logo, o acórdão do Tribunal Constitucional já o dizia em 94. Quanto ao direito à coadjuvação, designadamente por parte dos tribunais e das autoridades judiciárias, também concordamos com Nuno Pissarra, na obra citada, quando diz que a coadjuvação pode ter duas vertentes, ou a solicitação aos tribunais de medidas coercitivas com vista à recolha de meios de prova, ou a solicitação direta de envio de documentação. Mas os órgãos jurisdicionais a quem for solicitada a coadjuvação deverão sempre ter em conta os pertinentes princípios caracterizadores do Estado de Direito e designadamente o da separação de poderes, o da necessidade e da proporcionalidade, bem como o da concordância prática, ao proceder à devida ponderação de bens e interesses jurídicos em presença com vista à resposta a tal solicitação. Vou saltar, só finalizar com aquilo que me parece mais discutível, que é a situação do segredo de justiça. Não nos parece claro que o regime processual penal, para que remete atualmente o regime jurídico dos inquéritos parlamentares, imponha, sem mais, a transmissão de elementos constantes de processos judiciais em segredo de justiça. Desde logo, diga-se que hoje a questão coloca-se com outra dimensão, visto que precisamente desde 2007 o segredo de justiça nos processos penais deixou de ser a regra. A regra é agora a da publicidade, sendo o segredo de justiça a exceção à regra. Mas nos casos em que o mesmo vigore, que poderão ser precisamente os de maior repercussão pública, admitimos que a transmissão de elementos, ao menos de imediato, possa apresentar-se como problemática. Ora, a aplicação do regime processual penal apenas prevê a possibilidade de transmissão de elementos em segredo de justiça, desde que necessária a outro processo de natureza criminal, ou à instrução de processo disciplinado de natureza pública, ou à adoção de pedido de indemnização civil. Não vislumbramos, pois, a imposição de transmissão a uma comissão parlamentar de inquérito por força da aplicação do regime processual penal, tal como previsto no número 7 do artigo 13º da RGIP. Termino no número 9, para não me alongar mais. Penso que é possível concluir que, ainda que as diferentes naturezas e posturas, política num caso, jurídica noutro, possam potenciar alguma controvérsia e fricção entre o órgão Parlamento e o órgão Tribunais, a consciência clara e rigorosa de tais distintas naturezas, competências e objetivos, e sobretudo a compreensão e o convencimento da igual importância e dignidade das mesmas para a defesa e prosecução do interesse público, acabam por impor uma colaboração mútua, ainda com o devido respeito pelas funções próprias de cada um. Muito obrigado.
Thank you, Mr. Cunha, for this very interesting presentation. I think now we have some time to either to ask questions directly to the presentation or to share your own experiences with all the different matters and subjects that Mr. Cunha has raised in his speech. So who would like to start? I see many volunteers.
If you want him to finish, I'll be here.
Okay. From Bosnia, I guess. Yes. Maybe you can introduce briefly yourself, your name, and where you're coming from. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. I'm a legal officer. Hi, I'm legal officer with the OSCE, but I came together with the Bosnian delegation. I will ask maybe a little bit provocative question. We see what is the understanding, what is the judicial inquiry, and what is the parliamentary one. But let's say it's a very clear question, if the lines are so strict, do you think then that the court should decide on immunity of politicians of members of parliament, for instance. One example. Because it is the politicians that decide on their immunity, whether to lift immunity or not, in a case they are summoned to court.
Creio que a pergunta não tem muito a ver com as comissões de inquérito. As imunidades dos deputados estão previstas na lei e, portanto, a imunidade ou o levantamento da imunidade está previsto na lei. Isso não tem muito a ver com as comissões de inquérito, tem a ver com os processos judiciais em que algum membro do Parlamento é arguído. E, portanto, aí, quando isso se verifica, aplicamos a lei e o que a lei diz é que, em muitos casos, portanto, depende do próprio Parlamento, em determinados casos. Mas não é, digamos, não tem a ver com as questões do relacionamento dos tribunais com as comissões de inquérito, tem a ver com o relacionamento dos tribunais com o Parlamento no âmbito dos processos judiciais.
Yeah, it's about separation of powers. I don't think Parliament should decide on the immunity. It's the court always, but usually that's not the case, for instance. Mm-hmm.
Yes, please.
Just to contribute to that discussion. We have the question of immunities and of the members of parliaments in the special law, the statute of the MPs. And in our case, in fact, is the MPs that are judges about themselves. That's the case, yes. Because that's right. Because if a court wants to hear some MP as a witness, for instance, he has to send the request for the speaker, for the president of the parliament, and it's up to a parliamentary committee, which is the Committee on Ethics, to decide if it should be decided according to the request of the court or not. Generally, they decide according to the request of the court, but sometimes it's not the case. And in fact, it's a very criticized system because it's the MPs themselves that decide. But that's our system.
Can you make a parallel about discussion of separation of powers?
Yes. Yes. Since I have the micro, can I ask just a quick question to?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So
from the Portuguese bench.
Oh, okay. So
behind.
Oh, Fatima, yes, she's a big expert in inquiry committees, okay. So she must speak first.
Boa tarde, Dr. Fátima Brandes Mendes. Gostava de perguntar qual é a sua opinião acerca das provas que são obtidas através dos depoentes presencialmente, a nível de se há ou não violação dos direitos, liberdades e garantias, uma vez que em Portugal, pelo menos, é prática os depoentes estarem sujeitos a 7 e 8 horas de interrogatório sem contraditório, sendo que as decisões, as audiências são públicas. Também, uma vez que podem correr paralelamente processo judicial e em comissão e uma comissão parlamentar de inquérito, se os depoentes têm ou não direito de se remeter ao silêncio, porque o que quer que digam pode ser contra eles usado. Obrigada.
Antes de responder, devo dizer que li com muito interesse esta obra, que é sobre inquéritos, as comissões parlamentares de inquéritos de Portugal, no Portugal de 76 a 2015. Obra da senhora doutora que agora interveio. Se bem percebi, relação à relevância das provas para o processo judicial, eu acho que não tem valor, ou seja, tem valor indiciário, pode ter valor que o tribunal entender na sua livre apreciação, mas não pode estar adstrito a um valor prévio tabular que lhe seja dado por qualquer decisão alheia, designadamente prévia das comissões parlamentares. Agora, podem ser úteis, por isso é que até a própria Comissão de Veneza, que eu aqui referi neste acórdão, também sublinha isso, que deve haver um maior relacionamento e troca de informações, designadamente entre o Ministério Público e as comissões parlamentares e vice-versa, que muitas vezes têm falhado, porque isso é útil quer para o trabalho das comissões parlamentares, quer para o trabalho do Tribunal. Não que uma determine alguma coisa em relação à outra, mas são informações que podem dar origem a indícios, a prova e portanto, a serem eficazes. Portanto, isto quanto a um ponto. Quanto ao outro ponto, eu acho que sim, que obviamente que, tal como no processo penal, quem estiver numa situação que pode ser arguído, designadamente, tem o direito constitucional de se remeter ao silêncio e de não falar. Portanto, isso acho que é um direito que deve ser invocado em qualquer circunstância, quer no tribunal, quer nas próprias comissões, quer. Quanto a isso, não tenho dúvida.
Thank you very much. Is there anybody else for the question? Yes, Portugal again, and then Cyprus. I think, no, it's, she was first, and then Cyprus.
Boa tarde, meu nome é Isabel Pereira, eu venho da Assembleia Legislativa da Madeira. É uma questão muito particular, mas que já agora gostava de ouvir a sua opinião. Não sei se há aqui mais algum país que tenha também uma situação de parlamentos regionais, mas nós na Madeira temos também o nosso Parlamento e temos também uma legislação sobre as comissões parlamentares de inquérito dessa região autónoma, que estamos agora neste momento em processo de alteração legislativa também. E uma das questões que se coloca é de que, relativamente às sanções que podem ser aplicadas pelo não cumprimento das determinações da Comissão de Inquérito, seja na presença para prestar depoimentos, seja na entrega de documentos, é de que, supostamente, por ser legislação regional, não podemos incorporar uma norma que aplique efeitos de natureza penal, como, por exemplo, qualificar como crime de desobediência. E tendo em conta que, efetivamente, a Constituição determina que há este tipo de relacionamento, há estes poderes das comissões de inquérito, e que se calhar não faz muito sentido, não sei, fazer esta distinção pelo facto de serem comissões parlamentares de inquérito do Parlamento Regional relativamente ao Parlamento Nacional, gostaria já agora de ouvir qual é a sua opinião sobre o assunto, se faz sentido que haja esta restrição, ou se eventualmente, apesar de ser uma comissão de inquérito de uma região autónoma, poderia ter o direito, digamos assim, a ter também na sua legislação uma norma penal dessa natureza.
Mas uma vez que essa consequência penal está prevista na lei nacional, o que querem é algo de diferente? Porque ela já está prevista para qualquer recusa injustificada, constitui um crime de desobediência qualificada, prevista e punida penalmente.
Portanto, o que me está a dizer é que a norma penal normal, digamos assim, para recusa, que a recusa de prestar, desde que seja justificado por uma autoridade, que a recusa de cumprimento já previa a situação.
O que a lei diz é que será comunicado, nesse caso, ao Procurador-Geral da República para prosseguimento criminal.
E, portanto, dispensaria de estar previsto, é isso em seu entendimento, dispensaria de estar previsto na legislação sobre as comissões parlamentares de inquérito, é isso?
O regime jurídico não se aplica na Madeira?
Não, é que nós temos uma legislação própria, por isso mesmo é que eu estou a suscitar a questão. Nós temos um decreto legislativo que regula, tal e qual, sim, como a Lei Nacional regula para as comissões de inquérito da Assembleia da República.
Sim.
Nós temos legislação específica sobre isso. O problema é que, alegadamente, não podemos incluir uma norma idêntica à que tem a nível nacional, que culmina como crime de desobediência. Essa é que é a questão que eu estou a colocar, se faz sentido isso.
Bom, eu pensava que esta norma que se aplicava em todo o território nacional. portanto, que esta norma que previa que se aplicava em toda a... e estava convencido que sim.
Nós temos legislação especial na região autónoma da Madeira.
Posso ver depois isso. Podemos ver isso depois.
Muito obrigada. Obrigada.
Maybe you can continue that debate at the next poster session. Because I would like to give also some time to the colleague from Cyprus. Maybe you can also introduce yourself and then a brief question, please.
Nadia, I'm from Cyprus. Can I just quickly say that in Cyprus we're very strict as to the separation of powers. So, for example, in the immunity issue, it's the court that decides whether you have immunity or not. We're very strict about that. To that end, a parliamentary committee cannot scrutinise any issue that's before the courts, that's pending before the courts. The problem is, if the courts take a while to finish what they're doing, then by the time the parliamentary committee can start examining it, a lot of things have already passed, a lot of deadlines have already gone, and the people are still waiting to hear the facts of the case. And my first question is, how would you deal with this issue? And my second question is, the other thing we do is, if there is no pending investigation before the courts, once a committee is finished scrutinizing something and it considers there may be, not there will be, it doesn't decide, there may be criminal sanctions, it forwards the report to the Attorney General, who then decides whether to take it further or to, or not to do anything, really. And do you think, because it's been decided in Cyprus, but I would like a different view, do you think that this might constitute a violation in that they ask the Attorney General to have a look and decide whether he should take it further or whether he should just leave it there? Thank you.
Como eu tentei explicar na minha apresentação, houve uma altura em Portugal, até 1997, em que não era possível que houvesse sobre o mesmo objeto um inquérito parlamentar e um processo penal, pelo menos durante uma certa fase do processo penal, entre a pronúncia e a decisão. Isso era uma visão que hoje em dia nós entendemos que é errada. Ou seja, hoje em dia, não só nós, como até o Conselho da Europa, pela tal observações da Comissão de Veneza, entendem que, uma vez que os objetivos são diferentes, os tribunais, no caso criminal, exercem uma função jurisdicional para dizer se alguém é culpado ou não. As comissões de inquérito e o Parlamento exercem uma função política de apoio à legislação ou de controlo e fiscalização do governo e da administração, mas com um fim político e não jurisdicional, e, portanto, se os fins são diferentes, nada obriga a uma suspensão dos trabalhos de um ou de outro. E, portanto, eles podem sempre correr em separado. E, portanto, nunca há o perigo de ter que se esperar pelo resultado de um processo criminal para o Parlamento poder atuar de alguma maneira. De alguma maneira, dentro da sua função política. E, portanto, acho que esta é a visão correta e, portanto, são funções distintas, cada um, a separação de poderes também é isso, também é respeitar as funções, as competências e os objetivos de cada um e, portanto, não haver uma interferência. O que não quer dizer que não haja troca de informações. Por isso é que sempre que o Parlamento ou a Comissão de Inquérito detectar ilícitos criminais deve comunicá-los ao Ministério Público ou ao Procurador-Geral da República, mas sem que isso lhe interesse principalmente, porque o que lhe interessa é a função política, não é, digamos, a sentença criminal. E, portanto, que isso é um trabalho para os tribunais. E, portanto, acho que isso obsta esses tais problemas de ter que ficar suspenso qualquer trabalho do Parlamento à espera de um processo que pode realmente demorar muito tempo.
Thank you very much. I would like to give to Christoph the last possibility to ask a question and then to continue.
It's not a question, it's more a contribution. this topic was highly contested in Austria too, and in 2014 we had a comprehensive reform of the rules of procedure of committees of inquiry. And now there's a formalized way of communication or exchange between the committee of inquiry and judicial authorities. That means that the Ministry of Justice is informed about all decisions of the commission of inquiry, and if they think it necessary, they will start sort of formal procedures with the committee and with the president of the National Council, and the aim is to clarify proceedings or to order proceedings in a way that neither the judiciary nor the interferes with parliament, or the parliament interferes with the judiciary's work or with criminal prosecution. That means that, for instance, certain documents are not used in public sittings, or certain witnesses are not heard before they have been interrogated by the state prosecutor, or that certain witnesses are heard only in camera. And so far, this has worked very good, because the agreement that is reached between Parliament and the Ministry of Justice is made public, and all the procedures are transparent. And in the committee report, there's a detailed report of what was agreed with the Ministry of Justice, how was it carried out, etc., etc. And if there is any conflict about this agreement, then the Constitutional Court can act as a neutral umpire. And so far, this has worked out very well. And we had a committee of inquiry with parallel criminal proceedings, and there was no interference, and sort of both sides could profit from each other. For instance, the state prosecutor could use then some materials that only the committee had, and so on. So this is a model that worked out quite well, and this would it was designed after the Venice Commission made its amicus curiae brief, and sort of following the model or the suggestions and best practices from this amicus curiae.
Thank you, Christoph. Would you like immediately to go on? Because we are quite advanced with the time, and now we hear something about the unification of parliamentary committees of inquiry. Christoph, you have the floor.
Thank you. Oops. Thank you very much. We have now heard a lot about the relation between parliamentary committees of inquiry and the courts. And if we look at the problems that have been raised, and as well as when we look at how regulations have become more detailed and more complex in many parliaments, we can see that a kind of juridification of such committees happens and is discussed. And I will explore this development in my presentation in the context of the comprehensive reforms of the rules of procedure in Austria, which I just have mentioned. One should not take the phone to see the time. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
How much time do we have foreseen?
I would have seen.
Okay.
This reform in Austria focused on legal certainty, minority rights, the new role of the Constitutional Court as an arbitrator in certain conflicts. And the reform is special as it introduced a whole new concept of chairing the committee and leading its proceedings. Now the president of the chamber has to act as a chairperson, and the procedural judge stands by her side. Let me take a more sociological look at the relationship between parliamentary committees of inquiry and the courts now. When politicians speak about the strengths of committees of inquiry, they are likely to speak about asserting the truth, and they will promise that those responsible will face consequences. Similar arguments can be found in the media and in commentaries. We will hear about this more about this in the presentation from our colleague from Poland. Also, the staging of committee sittings and the reference to procedural notions will often, and on purpose, remind the audience of court proceedings. For us, and given what we have heard so far, it is clear that there's a huge difference between the purpose of a judicial court and a parliamentary committee. But we have to admit that it is hard to find a committee of inquiry whose procedural powers and regulations are not modeled on judicial proceedings in one way or the other. This practice is justified on grounds of fair procedures and the protection of the rights of witnesses and third parties. Judicial proceedings, or what is perceived as judicial proceedings, are regarded as the best guarantee to achieve those aims, and it's obvious that they can work. Committees of inquiry are political bodies made up of MPs that meet on parliamentary premises. And so, as we have already heard in the morning, the ways members talk and act will be guided by political and parliamentary conventions. In contrast, courts are judicial bodies. Judges, state attorneys, and lawyers have a special procedural training. They must argue along judicial lines, and their ways of acting, speaking, and deciding will be highly influenced by each group's professional ethos and practical convention. When I outline this here, it seems self-evident. But in parliamentary practice and its reception in the media and also in the academia, it's often not understood. Here, the focus is on rules, but not on ethos, training, or professional practice. The transfer of judicial procedures is often viewed as a guarantee for fair and efficient procedures. There seems to be a conviction that you just have to follow the rules to achieve these aims. However, as studies and experience show, most people, including politicians in Europe, think that court proceedings are done like in American films or TV series, and this is how they will often act. This is what we experienced a lot in Austria. With this in mind, let's turn to the development of procedural rules in the Austrian National Council. In 1920, Austria got a constitution that established an extreme parliamentary system. But the strong parliament was characterized by a strong reluctance to grant the minority the right to establish parliamentary committees of inquiry. Also, the National Council decided that committees of inquiry should not follow parliamentary rules, but they should work on the basis of criminal procedures. As a majority was needed to set up a committee of inquiry, such committees were a rare occurrence. In fact, it was only public pressure or outrage over political scandals that led to such committees in the National Council. Two committees became notorious in the 1980s. One dealt with illegal arms trade, the other with a huge insurance fraud, and both involved leading government members. The reports of both committees outlined the weaknesses and problems that came with the application of criminal procedures not understood by parliamentarians, and they urged that something should be done to avoid wrong accusations and degrading treatment of witnesses in committee and in the public. It took until 1997, when the National Council agreed on independent rules of procedure for committees of inquiry. In order to avoid confusions with criminal procedure, the new rules incorporated regulations from civil procedure. Also, they regulated only bits and parts of the procedure and referred to the National Council standing orders for everything else. But the major innovation was the creation of a so-called procedural advocate, a jurist elected by the committee that should safeguard the fundamental and personality rights of witnesses. Although this procedural advocate had no specific powers apart from the right to speak and to demand certain votes, it was expected that he would fulfill his assigned task on grounds of expertise and professional standing. Also, witnesses were allowed to bring a person in their confidence to the hearings. This person can advise witnesses, but it has no right to speak or to appeal to the committee. The use of parliamentary committees of inquiry was intensified from 2006 onwards. Now, it became clear that the rules did not work as expected. A lot of the regulations were contested, certain rules proved to be inadequate, and a lot seemed to be missing. Also, some of those committees had highly controversial chairmen from opposition parties. Other parties criticized them for their aspirations and for pushing their very own agenda. Under these conditions, the role of the procedural advocate changed. Maybe it was the designation procedural, maybe it was their personality, but some of them became central actors in the committee. You can. So this one was very influential. They were asked to act as arbitrators between the conflicting groups within the committees or between the committees and other state bodies. These developments were challenging as the new role of the procedural advocate had no legal basis, and also he was asked for advice on matters of the parliament's standing orders that he was not familiar with. Almost at the same time, the opposition started new attempts to establish a minority right to set up parliamentary committees of inquiry. And soon it became clear that such rights would be only possible in the context of a comprehensive reform of procedures, and the price for comprehensive reform of procedures would be minority rights. In 2014, political agreement on this reform was reached. The new rules of procedure established a comprehensive parliamentary regime, from the motion to set up a committee of inquiry to its final report. It comprises often very detailed definitions, organizational matters, various minority rights and rules and competences for conflict resolution, secrecy and data protection. Interestingly, the rules about summoning and questioning witnesses remained almost untouched. But all people involved had to admit that it would have been very difficult to go beyond what was already there. One of the most contested points in the reform talks was the question of who should chair committee proceedings. The parties in government were willing to concede minority rights and on the condition that parliamentary committees of inquiry would have a more sober character. They should neither act like a revolutionary tribunal nor the Spanish Inquisition. Some proposed that the judge should henceforth chair a committee of inquiry. In fact, they could refer to a model used in a provincial parliament, where a judge leads the questioning of witnesses in committees, but has no other roles in proceedings. Proponents of this approach referred to professional experience as a guarantee for fairness and efficiency. This proposal was met with skepticism, and doubts were raised if a judge could be able to understand political dynamics. Others proposed that the president of the National Council or one of her deputies should chair the committee. She would not be a member, and she would guarantee an impartial chair. In the end, agreement was found on a mixture of both approaches. The parties in opposition agreed, as they regarded the enforcement of minority rights more important than the matter of the chairperson. Also, clear procedural rules and the possibility to bring certain conflicts before the Constitutional Court were regarded as a means to limit the powers of the chair and strengthen the opposition. Now, the president of the National Council shall chair parliamentary committees of inquiry. She may ask her deputies to in her stead in chairing and may also entrust them with other duties. The chair is neither entitled to vote, nor may she file a motion in the committee. Her role is to preside over the proceedings and the hearings of witnesses. She shall represent the committee vis-à-vis third parties and inform the public. Still, this could be a very powerful role, especially as she could be the face of the committee and she could set the modalities of proceedings. But the chairperson is obliged to consult with the procedural judge, a function I will describe in a second. In all procedural matters, that means in all that she can do, and she has to give due consideration to the latter's legal opinion. Also, the chair shall, as far as possible, reach consensus with the parliamentary groups in all procedural matters. The Standing Orders Committee has to elect a procedural judge in the process of setting up a committee of inquiry. The judge has to be an appointed judge, either permanently retired or on special leave. The procedural judge has to attend all sittings of the committee in an advisory capacity. Whenever her duties so require, she shall immediately address herself to the chairperson. She shall assist the chairperson in preparing the working plan of the committee, inform the witnesses of their rights and duties, and shall be the first to question witnesses. The idea was that she should set the stage for further procedures and ensure efficiency in this way. The procedural judge shall also warn the chairperson of any inadmissible question and observe the rules on secrecy of information. Finally, she shall prepare the draft report for the committee. Thus, the judge is entrusted with duties that were the domain of parliamentarians. The procedural advocate that had been introduced in 1997 has retained her function, but now the role is delineated in a much clearer way and focused on safeguarding fundamental and personality rights of witnesses. Together, the three, chairperson, judge, and advocate, shall ensure that the committee observes the rights of witnesses and also of affected third parties. They are, in a very limited way, accountable, but they cannot be removed by the committee nor by the chamber. The judge can only be removed upon request by the president or of the chamber or the chairman, because the two of them have to act together in a very close way. The new rules of procedure came into force on 1st of January 2015, and a committee of inquiry was installed immediately afterwards. It concluded its work in October 2016 with a report, as the maximum time granted by the rules of procedures was up. Another committee of inquiry will take up its work tomorrow. In many ways, the juridification of procedures, as I called them initially, seems to have worked out. MPs, as well as government officials and court representatives, alike hailed the smooth functioning with regard to proceedings, the flow of information, the security of sensible information and conflict resolution. Indeed, these are matters that can be regulated, provided good sake. Here, the focus is on operational matters. The balance is mixed when it comes to process control, efficiency of questioning, and outcome of proceedings. The chairperson of the committee has become, quite as intended, a mostly neutral actor that had by no means her own political agenda. But the price was quite high, as the function proved to be very time-consuming. In light of this experience, the second president will chair the next committee of inquiry. It turned out that the chairperson would always seek consensus with the political groups, who continued to play the dominating role in the proceedings. She could not do otherwise because she has always to find consensus with the political groups in her function, and could be no difference in the committee of inquiry. This meant that the political groups structured more or less the interrogation of witnesses, and neither the chairperson nor the procedural judge intervened much. Journalists and witnesses alike complained about long and uncoordinated ways of questioning. There are 6 political groups, and they called the procedural judge the 7th group. It was similar with regard to the committee report. The procedural judge prepared a 500-page report that was more or less a compilation of the hearings of witnesses. Unlike the political groups, he lacked the means and knowledge to analyze all documents received by the committee. No wonder that each of the 6 political groups made its own minority report. In the end, there were 7 reports instead of 1 or 2, and almost none of them received wider attention in the media. So we assume that this will be take a long time to learn. We are still, a lot of people are convinced that this model might work out, but what has been proved is that MPs imagine the judge to come and lead the proceedings in a perfect way, and they did not think about the personality of the judge or whether he might be able to do it and might bring this experience. And we will see how this works in the 2nd committee, where they have taken a former vice president of the Supreme Court. But it will certainly take time, and this will be difficult, and it will depend, as has been pointed out in the morning, a lot on the virtue of the parliamentarians involved, but also of the judge involved. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Christoph. Is there anybody who would like to react with a question or a contribution concerning his or her own experiences? Yeah, from Denmark. Microphone.
Anton Jacobsen, I'm from the Danish Parliament in the Legal Services Office. This is all extremely interesting to us because, as I think was mentioned quite briefly when the results of the questionnaire were gone through this morning, we don't actually have a system of parliamentary committees of inquiry in that sense, so we're extremely curious to learn new things, and this system with a judge on board, as well as a lawyer, is quite fascinating to hear about. I'd like to ask if there were any concerns with professional integrity from the judges' associations, perhaps. Were there any concerns about politicizing the role of judges in general, becoming being seen as an actor on behalf of political entities rather than the sort of withdrawn neutral bodies that judges traditionally like to represent, and the same in terms of the procedural advocate. Were there any concerns from the legal community about being overly politicized?
No, the only concern was who should pay for him. No, the procedural advocate became, as I said, quite prestigious. And we had high-ranking former state attorneys, and also, like, the one time the former president of the Chamber of Lawyers acted as a procedural advocate. So this became quite prestigious. And with the judge, it was sort of the same thing. I mean, basically, they try to get people that are retired, so there would be no compromise. But the Ministry of Justice agreed that if they would take an active judge, he would get special leave, and he would not act as a judge for the period of the Committee of Inquiry. And yes, to answer the question with the payment Parliament is paying.
Thank you, Christoph. Another question immediately to this contribution? Yes, George from Greece.
Uh, The problem, I think, is the nature of these committees. And I have to say that I'm afraid of this juridification of the parliamentary committees of inquiry. Because, first of all, these bodies are parliamentary bodies and they have political competences. I think that we have to discuss about what is the task of such a committee. The task is, above all, a kind of political control, of parliamentary control. It's the upper stage, I could say, of parliamentary control. And after this, they have some similarities with judicial bodies. And there is confusion about their role. I think that there is, of course, the separation of powers, but there is also, it is for the first theme, there is also the intersection of powers. And so the constitutions have to decide, do they want these committees to be political or crossing powers, political and judicial? I think that the Austrian example is leading to the second way. It is a mixture of competences. I can see and I can say, if so, we have to discuss about how these committees will have both tasks. Is it possible? I think that we have to stay in the first concept of these bodies, that is, political bodies, and then we have to discuss about the involvement of judicial power when issues, criminal issues, for example, have arisen. This is the main theme we can discuss first of all. And then, if we conclude, we can say, after all, we'll organize this institution in a judicial or in a political way.
Can I take that more as a statement than rather than a question? Because I would like to give enough time to my dear friend Albert Gores from the Belgian Parliament to, if you, because we still have an hour, and I think you should also have enough time to get your questions and have time for your presentation. The topic will be on a specific aspect, which is the question of secrecy in parliamentary inquiry committees. Albrecht, the floor is yours.
Okay, thank you. Dear colleagues, you will have gathered from what was said this morning that the issue of secrecy is very important when talking about parliamentary committees of inquiry. One speaker this morning said that committees of inquiry, their utility is that they provide immediately information to the people about events of exceptional gravity. Of course, secrecy goes in the opposite direction. I will explain to you how the Belgian House of Representatives deals with secret information, or maybe we should say more broadly, sensitive information. And my presentation will focus on three issues. What sensitive information can committees of inquiry receive? How is secrecy guaranteed? And what is the status of this information that the committee of inquiry possesses for authorities outside Parliament and for the public in general? Before I turn to these questions, I would like to briefly give you the broader picture in Belgium. What kind of committees of inquiry do we have? First, I must say that in Belgium, parliamentary inquiries may coincide with judicial inquiries, but they may not hamper judicial inquiry. We have this rule now for 20 years, and it doesn't seem to cause much problems. Committees of inquiry have the same powers as investigating magistrates, and this is important for the subject of my talk. Committees of inquiries may summon witnesses, but all witnesses is not only public authorities, but also private persons. First observation, most, I would say, all parliaments that are represented here, they have public meetings of their plenary sessions. That is maybe not always the case for committee meetings. It is so in the Belgian House, and it is also the case for the committees of inquiry. They normally are public, and they only meet in camera when the committee of inquiry so decides. There is no list of in what case can the committee decide so. It's just a majority decision, and the committee will meet in camera. Now, what information do the committees of inquiry receive? So what sensitive information are we talking about? Classified information? Well, that's the only case where I must say no. In Belgium, committees of inquiry do not have access to classified information. Some information is restricted, and then it can be communicated to a committee of inquiry, but not, strictly speaking, classified information. Then a very important category of information is the information covered by professional secrecy. That includes also judicial information, information held by, for example, the fiscal authorities, by lawyers, doctors, etc. And then we have a rule since about 20 years that the situation of a person who is bound by professional secrecy is the same in court as before a committee of inquiry. So he may speak, he may answer the questions, but he is not bound to do so. In practice, most witnesses, they speak freely. And often they will testify only on condition of secrecy. That means that the committee has to meet in camera, in private. And there we have a peculiarity in our law. We have secret meetings, but there's an additional condition that can be added. A witness can ask that the committee expressly binds itself to maintain secrecy, so absolutely, for also the future. There is other information that can be sensitive, information that is sensitive with regard to the right to respect for private and family life. commercial secrets. And of course, these are legal grounds for having closed-door sessions, but you can also have pragmatic reasons, because a witness may be encouraged to speak, to give more information if doors are closed. Now, how do we guarantee secrecy? We have in our rules of procedure a rule that concerns the members of the committee, and we have, and that it's only a disciplinary sanction, and we have a rule in the penal law for all other participants in the parliamentary inquiry. So for them it's a punishable offense to break the to violate the secrecy. It is not so for the members. Why is this so? It is because we have a rule, like many parliaments have, of parliamentary irresponsibility, call it freedom of speech or parliamentary privilege. That means when a member of a committee of inquiry would speak in the plenary session and would by doing so reveal elements that were secret, he cannot be prosecuted. But he can incur a sanction that will be imposed by the Speaker of the House. So, what is the rule in case an MP violates the obligation of secrecy? He will lose membership of the Committee of Inquiry, but not only of the Committee of Inquiry, also membership of all other organs of the House for the rest of the parliamentary term, where the rule of secrecy applies. He will not be replaced by his parliamentary group, and for 3 months he will lose 20% of the parliamentary allowance. Now, I must say that this rule has never been applied. There's several reasons for this. Most of the time, what are the most frequent violations of secrecy? It's a leak in the press. You don't know who did it. So, second problem is who is going to investigate. We don't have in the House an apparatus of who is going to investigate leaks. And there, of course, is maybe also political reasons. I would say that the same problem also exists for other participants in the parliamentary inquiries, because if you have a leak in the press and you maybe think it is some expert or never mind somebody on the staff, you will need to have an investigation. But who is going to carry out that investigation? It must be the judicial authorities with the police. So if you make a complaint about this, you will invite the judiciary to search your premises, to interrogate your members, etc. So maybe that's another reason why these leaks are very rarely investigated. Yes, there are also some practical measures that are taken to keep information confidential. It has been talked about also this morning. It goes from very light procedures to very heavy procedure, like eyes-only procedure, which means that documents have to be inspected in one room and no notes can be taken, no phones can be used. A last question I wanted to address is, what can be done with information that is handled as confidential. Once the, for example, during the functioning of the inquiry committee, but also afterwards. What happens if a lawyer asks to have the text of a testimony? What happens if a court orders to have the text of a testimony? It can be a testimony in public, but also in private. And then, earlier on, I made the distinction when the committee has bound itself expressly to secrecy, it will never hand over any document or text of testimony, not even when it is ordered by a judge. That are our rules of procedure, and they have been worked out some 20 years ago on the advice of a former attorney general. So we consider that in the separation of power in Belgium, it is the house and only the house that can decide on the what to do with documents, even when there is a request from a judicial authority. And then lastly, there is also the question of what to do in the committee reports. That's more difficult to give you a theoretical answer. Of course, information may not be divulged when the committee has expressly bound itself to secrecy. But in general, all information that can be reduced to one individual will not be mentioned in the report. So that is to give you a general outline of how we treat secret information in Belgium. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Alberic, for this very interesting and timely presentation. Mm-hmm. I can imagine that there are secret issues, are also issues in other parliaments, so I would like to know if there are anybody who wants to share his or her experiences and or has a question. So I open the registration for contributions, maybe. I look there in the corner. It's you are from? Maybe you can introduce yourself, your name, and your parliament. Ah, the microphone, sorry.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay. My name is Zoran Skubic. I'm from the Slovenian Parliament, the National Assembly. I'm also an acting secretary of PCI now for 2 months. Also, I had an experience because our legal system is very undernourished because we have a very old law, 1993. We are more or less governed by practice, not procedure, but more or less practice, what we got from our past mistakes, so to speak. Also, it was very interesting about the secrecy in the Belgian system. I had a case, I still have a case, where we had a request from the police to get a hold of our documents and also our testimonials, also the ones that work in camera. Well, we don't have explicit legislation covering that. It's more or less when it's governed by other laws. So it's like more similar, simile ad simile. So we kind of regulated that with a special decree of the committee saying that, well, okay, you can see it, but you have to respect the secrecy regulation that is, you have to handle it discreetly. So you only can come to the house, of Parliament, and you can see it, but you cannot reproduce it. You can also just see it like the members of Parliament can see it, if they wanted the classified information, also the classified documents and also the classified testimonials. So this is just my experience. I have no question. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there another question or contribution? Yes, from Turkey.
Özcan Altay from Turkey Research Department. Well, it will be a problem for explain or reveal the documents that are deemed as secret by the committee would be a problem for the officers, for us, but would be no problem for the MPs because of the immunity, you know. But it is punishable. If the immunity was lifted by the parliament, the penal code openly penalizes it as a crime, as the revealing of secret documents. So I would definitely say that it would be a punishable offense in the sense in our practice.
Thank you very much. Is there somebody else? Because we are very well in time, and you may ask questions now to Alberich, but also to the make comments on the previous presentations. I saw a hand over there from Portugal.
Portugal, obrigado. Referiu que as comissões... Ok. Sim? Referiu que a regra das comissões parlamentares de inquérito, bem como das comissões permanentes, é da publicidade. Só será à porta fechada se a comissão assim o decidir. Qual é o alcance exato da publicidade? Qualquer cidadão, como em Portugal, pode estar sentado em sua casa e acompanhar as sessões da comissão de inquérito, tem acesso às gravações de cada sessão da comissão de inquérito, pode expurgar as partes, pode transcrever o que quiser de uma sessão da Comissão Parlamentar de Inquérito. Muito obrigada.
It depends very much on each committee of inquiry. Some proceedings have been transmitted directly on the television. Some on the internet. Some of the minutes of the committee in public hearings have been published. And the public can also assist in the committee meetings in the tribune, you say? The tribune, yeah. And the press is, of course, also very interested in the proceedings.
Thank you very much. Another question also from Portugal, with interpretation.
How this works? Is it working? Yeah. My question is very quick, and I think it's a bit related to our Greek, is it Greek? From Greece, yeah? Greek colleague. And is about the intervention of our Austrian colleague. So, you provided an answer to the question 3.6, saying that the inquiry committee can only produce evidence and draw political conclusions. Therefore, why you need a judge assisting the chairperson of a committee? Thank you very much.
So, taking a judge has more to do with the expectations people have from judges than with a judicial function. It just, we had a lot of committees of inquiry that ended in havoc. And we have certain members who always, the only purpose they see in their life is to find the smoking gun, sort of. And So the idea to have a judge was to make proceedings more sober. This is not to make the claim that the committee of inquiry shall be sort of like a court, but just something to keep members more quiet and to bring some more order and efficiency in it. For example, in 2006 we had a committee of inquiry where one of these members had the idea of questioning witnesses for 8 hours and not letting them go to the toilet. So this is crazy, and I was secretary of this committee, and I was urging him to suspend proceedings and to make, but he said no. And the introduction of this function with the judge was sort of to prevent such things, and to have someone who says, well, if I would have to interrogate or to question this person in court, I could not do this. And this is sort of the idea behind. And also, when it comes sort of to secrecy or to look at such rules, then this judge has an important function, because he has no interest, sort of a political interest, to have these things published or whatever. And so he can say, stop, you are not supposed to use this document in the public sitting, and we have to continue in camera. So from this perspective, it should not be seen as a mixture of judicial proceedings and parliamentary proceedings, but more as of sort of someone that can intervene and that has, because he was a judge before, a certain authority. And I wanted just to say something on what was our Slovenian colleague said. We had the same problems, and when we made this reform of the rules of proceedings, we made sure to have regulations for this case so that the committee can decide on whether it will give documents to judicial authorities, and after the committee has been closed, that the president of the chamber can make this decision. And also with regard to secrecy, what is quite interesting about the Austrian approach is that we have procedures for disqualification of classified documents and reclassification, and also the Constitutional Court may decide in such cases. There has not been a decision of the Constitutional Court, but already the demand to disqualify a document has led to political talks and helped a lot in difficult situations, because we were like confronted with the situation that the committee would demand the same documents from a number of different state bodies, and one would send it all as non-public documents, and the other would send them as classified documents. And then, of course, the members said, well, we take everything that is non-public, and the other said, well, mine were classified. And so these regulations helped to solve such conflicts. And yes, they are not so bad, I would say, and they are available in English on our website. So if you're interested, we can distribute them.
Thank you. I think we closed the cycle by a last contribution made by Albrecht on.
Well, I just wanted to say 2 points on the classified documentation. In Belgium, too, I think in practice, many of the documents that normally would remain classified are declassified to be able to give them to the inquiry committees. There hasn't been really a conflict between intelligence services, for instance, or committees of inquiry. And then as regards the magistrates, we also have in practice in most committees a magistrate which acts as an expert of the committee under the authority of the committee. And moreover, and that's also important, when a committee which has a lot of power decides to seize documents, then it has to pass through a magistrate of the Court of Appeal, who is under the authority of the president of the Committee of Inquiry, but it is a magistrate, and he will look into it that all the legal guarantees are respected, because a seizure is a very important measure. It has to do with basic liberties, so it is very important that the magistrate looks into it.
Thanks again. I would like to cut here the discussion and turn to a feature which was successfully introduced at the Dublin seminar last year in November. It was introduced by Peter Cabot, he's deputy ECBD correspondent of the Belgian Chamber and unfortunately cannot be with us today. He will not be live with among us, but he has registered a video recording and will speak to us now from the screen and tell us what these poster sessions are about. And you will be his voice.
Yes, I will just introduce Peter's video and mention that I hope he will be able to pass on his enthusiasm for poster sessions as he did to us. This first poster session will feature posters from Austria, presented by Christoph and by Rosie, from Bosnia and Herzegovina, presented by Sonia Abdulovsky and Alexander Gutali, from Hungary by Scholt Buksa, sorry, and by Slovenia, presented by Aldiana Hametovic. So first the video.
Ladies and gentlemen, dear colleagues, my dear friends, my name is Peter Cabot, and I am ECPRD Deputy Correspondent for the Belgian House of Representatives. A few months ago, I sent an email to Christophe, Fernando and Dalila to inform them that I could not attend the Lisbon seminar. They kindly asked me to assist them with the organization and introduction of the poster sessions anyway. So here we go, all the way from Belgium. At the Dublin seminar in November 2016, we organized poster sessions for the first time in the ECPRD history. It was a great success, and we want to continue this effort at the Lisbon seminar. The objective of the poster sessions is to facilitate additional short presentations about a single interesting aspect of the seminar's theme. The posters will be displayed in just a minute in the coffee break area. And during breaks today and tomorrow, the poster owners will be available to engage in discussion on the poster content. Today, a first group of posters will be presented, and tomorrow, a second group will be displayed. Our Irish colleagues also introduced the poster reward, appropriately awarded by popular vote. Our Portuguese colleagues will continue this tradition, so tomorrow you will have the opportunity to select your favorite poster. ECPRD is not only a website and an instrument to gather information from other parliaments. ECPRD is also a family of professionals, parliamentary professionals. For some of you, these meetings are an opportunity to meet again. For others, it might be your first ECPRD experience altogether. Poster sessions surely allow us to strengthen our knowledge, but also to strengthen our family ties. So we basically want you to talk to each other. That is the reason why I invite all of you together to follow your Portuguese hosts to the coffee break venue, to get some refreshments and to start exploring the posters that were kindly prepared by our colleagues. Finally, I want to thank Fernando and Dalila and their team for organizing this seminar and to allow me to introduce the poster sessions from Brussels. I wish you inspiring poster sessions and happy networking. That's all from Brussels. Bye now.
Yes, thank you, Peter. And I would like to ask Alberic to convey our greetings and thanks to Peter when you are back in town. I don't think that this will be a standard procedure in seminars that we listen to video presentations. We all hope that you will also be able in the future to come and join us in person.
I send him a WhatsApp.
Yeah, please use all this new media for all those things. So I don't know where these posters are. The only thing, there was probably some coffee or something. Yes. Only. I would like to ask you to be back at 4:30 that we can resume our session for our last two presentations and many, many other questions.
We make an applause for Peter so I can send him. Okay.
Dear colleagues, I hope that you had interesting poster sessions and opportunity for a lot of informal exchanges. And now we formally would like to resume our meeting with the classical style, which means with two remaining presentations from Germany and Poland, and hopefully with same amount of interesting questions and contributions as it was the case before the poster sessions. So at first, I have the pleasure to introduce two compatriots of mine, Mrs. Reese and Mr. Hoppe, on a joint venture about conflicts in parliamentary committees of inquiry. And I give now the floor to Mrs. Reese. You have the floor, please.
Yes, hello, everybody. Together, we are doing the presentation on the issue conflicts in PCIs. First, my colleague Tillmann will start with a short introduction, and then I will continue with two case studies.
Thank you very much. I've been working on several inquiry committees in the German Parliament, and actually in the last 5 years I have not been in the German Parliament, but I have been working for the Council of Europe mainly, supporting anti-corruption projects in the Balkans, Eastern Europe, Northern Africa, Middle East. And I was always confronted with the question, why is Germany successful in fighting corruption? Why is it successful in anti-corruption? What tool does Germany have so it ranks so high in all these indexes about, you know, being successful in fighting corruption? And I was saying, yeah, sure, we have free media, that's very important, free and strong media, and we have a well-educated middle class, educated in rule of law and in German Ordnung. But I'm always saying our most important anti-corruption tool are actually inquiry committees, our parliamentary inquiry committees. And why is that so? Well, first of all, because it's a minority right, and it's a really strong minority right. It means 25% of parliament can completely dominate the show. And we know corruption is always about abuse of power, and power, that's the majority, and we all know, and from many countries present or even beyond our region, the problem is often a majority that stays in power for years and decades and dominates the entire country and all three branches of power. And when you have a powerful minority of 25% that has the right to set up the inquiry, to request the evidence, to publish the results, in my opinion, it's a really important and powerful anti-corruption tool. And that's why we say, you see a sword here, it's a common saying in German academia to say inquiry committees are the sharpest sword of the opposition. Right now, our opposition has less than 25% because Angela Merkel, you know, she's so successful and we have this big coalition now for more than a decade. But our inquiry committees are so important that Parliament agreed even less than 25% can exercise all these rights related to an inquiry committee. And I must warn you because the two judgments you're going to hear now, which Birgit is going to present, are completely misleading. It's two judgments where the opposition was denied to get evidence they wanted. We present these cases because the organizers want them. They are interesting in a legal sense, and they are interesting to think about and to discuss. But please bear in mind, the reality is actually a huge trough of cases where the opposition got all kinds of evidences. in very important corruption cases. Actually, the first inquiry committee we had in the 40s, early 50s, was about bribery. Then it was about political finance. Then it was about bribery again. And there is a long line of jurisprudence where the Constitutional Court would repeatedly support the minority in getting the evidence is needed. The importance of inquiry committees in German law you can also see by the presence of this book. It's the statute on inquiry committees that regulates in detail what the Constitution is prescribing. It's 500 pages of really thin paper, smallly printed, full of case law. It's still bigger than the Austrian version. So we are in a competition here with Christoph. Let's see, like, when we meet in 1 or 2 years, probably his book will be bigger. Ah, so the Austrian version is easy reading and the German one is heavy and Schiller and Goethe and Kant and everything breathes in this heavy document. So I'm handing over to Birgit and looking forward to this very thrilling cases, actually. NSA and Snowden, what could be more interesting?
Thank you very much. Yes, with this general remarks in mind, I would now like to focus on conflicts in PCIs and their resolution by judicial proceedings. First, you have to be sure about the different conflict situations which may occur in PCIs. With this slide, I've tried to illustrate the conflicts within the PCI. Oh, my, that wasn't supposed here. And with the PCI. The conflict situation within the PCI seems to be easy to understand, at least on the first sight. There is a dissent between the PCI's majority here and the PCI's minority on a certain issue, for example, on taking a certain evidence. However, the conflict situation within a PCI becomes quite more complicated if there is a special minority situation, which Tillmann already talked about. In this case, the committee's minority doesn't represent a one-quarter minority of the Bundestag's members. I will come back to this problem later. Another point you have to keep in mind is that the conflict within the PCI may be connected with the federal government. As the PCI's majority is backing the government, there might be no big ambitions for the majority to investigate governmental failures. This situation can lead to a conflict within the PCI, even though you would locate the real conflict between the PCI and the government. But if you finally have a PCI's decision, for example, to get access to governmental files, the next conflict situation may occur if the government refuses to give access. This would be a conflict situation with the PCI. The following cases I want to explain in more detail are dealing with both situations, conflicts within the PCI and with the PCI. As you all know, the disclosures of Edward Snowden in 2013 resulted in a huge scandal concerning mass surveillance by the NSA and other intelligence services. In Germany, the Bundestag established a PCI to investigate the scope of the NSA spying activities and the involvement of German state bodies. In this context, the NSA committee unanimously decided to let Edward Snowden testify as a witness. Therefore, the federal government was requested to ensure the legal requirements for Snowden to stay in Germany. But the government gave a negative statement and suggested a hearing in Russia. Within the PCI, a conflict came into being about the question where the hearing should take place. The majority voted for a hearing in Russia. The minority wanted a hearing in Germany. The conflict became urgent when Snowden declared not to testify in Russia, but in Germany. The PCI's minority made several motions to get a decision which would lead to a stay of Snowden in Germany. As this failed, the PCI's minority tried to claim a minority right. In particular, the minority argued with a special situation which allows a hearing of Snowden only in Germany. in this case, the circumstances of the hearing are not only procedural matters being subject to the decision of the majority, but they are part of the minority right. In addition, another problem became obvious, namely the special minority situation in the NSA committee. The minority members in the NSA committee only represent a very small minority of the Bundestag's members. They don't represent the quorum of one quarter of the Bundestag's members that is laid down in the Constitution. Maybe we can go back to the here. The minority doesn't represent one quarter of the Bundestag's members. So we have to deal with two questions. Can the minority claim the place of Snowden's hearing as a minority right? And would the minority be a sufficient minority? Let's have a look at the relevant provisions of the PUAC.
Yeah,
you can show it. Ruling the minority rights as to taking evidence and providing judicial proceedings in cases of conflicts. According to paragraph 17, there's a right of the PCI's minority to take evidence. And in section 4, you can find the judicial remedy the minority can use if the majority refuses to take evidence. Looking at our cases, you would probably agree with the minority's opinion. If the hearing of Snowden only can take place in Germany, the minority right as to whether Snowden should testify must include the minority's right as to how or where he testifies. Furthermore, the PUAC provision constitutes a minority quorum referring to the committee members. It says one quarter of the committee members, irrespective in how far the Bundestag's members are represented. So what did the Federal Court of Justice rule? The investigating judge of the Federal Court of Justice ruled in favor of the minority. The judge followed the minority's arguments as to the scope of the minority rights. The minority rights can include matters of procedure or circumstances if they are essential for the evidence. As to the size of the committee's minority, the investigating judge didn't see any problem. The legislation of the PUAC is not bound to any constitutional quorum, but can grant further rights to the PCI's minority. But this was not the end of the judicial proceeding. On a complaint of the PCI's majority, the panel of the Federal Court of Justice had to decide. The panel ruled in favor of the majority. Not referring to the scope of minority rights as to the whether and how of taking evidence, the panel already didn't consider the size of the minority to be sufficient. In spite of the different wording in paragraph 17, the minority rights must stick to the quorum which is laid down in the Constitution. That means that the minority must represent one quarter of the Bundestag's members to be entitled to claim minority rights. The panel emphasized that the constitutional quorum stands for a general decision as to the balancing of majority and minority rights in PCIs. The constitutional quorum is binding because of its highest rank in the German legal system. I guess I kept my word that conflicts within PCIs can be very complicated. But let's have a look to another case, which deals with an outside conflict, namely between the PCI and the federal government. Therefore, we can stay with the NSA committee, but we have to focus on the probably well-known NSA selector lists. These lists contain the items which were used for the surveillance measures by the NSA and by the German intelligence service called BND. You can imagine that the cooperation between NSA and BND caused a special interest of the committee. The PCI made a decision to request access to the NSA selector lists. However, the federal government denied to give access because the NSA didn't approve. The BND and NSA have been cooperating on the basis of an agreement which requires confidentiality. As the NSA didn't approve the delivery of the lists, the federal government saw itself bound to the agreement. In this situation, we have to deal with the question, what are the limits of the PCI's right to take evidence or to get access to governmental documents? Can the government refer to international agreements to deny access? Or would the cooperation with foreign intelligence services would be a reason to refuse the delivery? Again, we should look at the relevant provisions of the PUAC, ruling the access to governmental documents and providing judicial proceedings in cases of conflicts. According to paragraph 18, the government is obliged to present the requested material. But this obligation is subject to constitutional limits. You see here, by constitutional law. The provision doesn't put the constitutional limits in concrete terms. However, there is a settled case law of the Federal Constitutional Court that refers to three constitutional limits: fundamental rights, welfare of state, and the government's decision-making process, which should not be disturbed by parliamentary scrutiny. The last limit is connected with the separation of powers principle. In section 3 of paragraph 18, you can find the judicial remedy if the government refuses the access. Furthermore, the PCI can refer to a general judicial proceeding, the so-called Organstreitverfahren, which is regulated in the German Constitution and which gives access to the Federal Constitutional Court. This Organstreitverfahren is applicable in cases of disputes between organs of the Constitution. You can imagine that the PCI's majority wasn't eager to apply for a judicial proceeding against the federal government. So it was up to the minority. Because of the special minority situation in the NSA committee, which was the critical factor in the Snowden case as well, the PCI's minority couldn't refer to paragraph 18. But with the Organstreitverfahren, two parliamentary groups of the Bundestag were entitled to apply for a finding. How did the Federal Constitutional Court deal with the above-mentioned questions? To reveal the outcome first, the Constitutional Court didn't assume an obligation to deliver the NSA selector lists. The reasoning can be summed up as follows. In principle, the right of the PCI to take evidence includes the access to the NSA selector lists, but you have to respect constitutional limits. The international agreement between the NSA and BND requiring confidentiality was not assessed to be a constitutional limit itself. The reason is that, in general, international agreements do not share the character and high rank of constitutional norms. However, in the next step, the court referred to the cooperation with foreign intelligence services and its functioning. The functioning of the cooperation was presumed to be a special aspect of the separation of powers principle. According to the separation of powers principle, the government's ability to act and to cooperate with foreign intelligence services is under a special protection. As the federal government had made it clear that the NSA would probably terminate the cooperation in case of any violation of the agreement, the court acknowledged a great interest not to disclose the information. Weighing the interests of the government not to disclose the information and the scrutiny interests of the parliament, the court presumed the government's interests to prevail. To this reasoning, you can imagine there has been a lot of critical review. In particular, there were serious concerns because the court developed new arguments excluding the PCI's scrutiny in a very sensitive field. Looking at both cases, the Snowden case and the selector lists case, there are a lot of interesting aspects for further discussion. But let me point out one aspect which links to our preliminary thoughts about minority rights. if you have a conflict on the first level of taking evidence, namely within the PCI, there are minority rights which give access to court. If you have a conflict on the second level of taking evidence, namely outside the PCI, for example, with the government refusing the access to files, there are minority rights to give access to court as well. Even though in our cases the PCI's minority finally wasn't successful, it should have become clear that minority rights are essential with regard to the taking of evidence and that they can make PCIs being a sharp sword. Thank you very much for your attention, and we are looking forward for your questions. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you very much. Are there questions indeed? So now there's the moment to ask them. I guess that Christoph would like to ask something. Microphone, please.
No question. I promised this to Tilman. I want to thank you very much because you gave a very good example of how courts and committees of inquiry intertwined at a different level that we have discussed so far. And also you presented a good example of how committees of inquiry act more and more in an international context. And I just want to report on two recent developments in Austria. I already talked about this cooperation with the courts, and we have a new committee of inquiry regarding the procurement of the Eurofighter. It starts tomorrow, and a lot of documents have been obtained in criminal cases and criminal investigation regarding this procurement of the fighter jets, and they came from Germany, Switzerland, Luxembourg, by legal assistance to the courts. And of course, the Committee of Inquiry cannot demand German courts or German authorities to hand over documents, but through the communication with the Ministry of Justice, they have sort of established a channel of communication with the courts that originally sent them to their Austrian counterparts, and now they have allowed that the Austrian courts give these documents from Germany, from Luxembourg, from Switzerland, etc., to the Committee of Inquiry, which is a very interesting development, because normally you say that the Committees of Inquiry do not have the basis for international assistance or legal assistance, and that there have been one or two singular cases in Germany. But to do it on this scale is a rather new development, and this is something that is very interesting, could be interesting for others here. And the second thing is that when you summon witnesses from abroad, you do not have any means to enforce this, because it would be an unfriendly act. But when it comes to such big companies like Airbus and Eurofighter, you know, there is the discussion, and we had sort of to give a legal opinion on this, that there's the new directive on public procurement, the new EU directive, and it says that you can exclude some company from public procurement if it does, if itself or its representatives do not cooperate with state organs of your state. And the investigative committee can be such an organ that falls under the public procurement directive. And so in Austria, there's now the discussion when the CEOs or other representatives of Eurofighter or Airbus do not cooperate, then the government could exclude them from the next procurement, which is also quite a strong weapon, because it gives you some means to enforce a summons from witnesses from abroad, which is also a very new development. Of course, you cannot do this with Edward Snowden, but you can do this maybe with Airbus.
Thank you very much. Are there other contributions or questions? Yes, George.
Just a question. Are there any conflicts which end in different conclusions in the same committee? And if so, what happens then?
Okay, yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, that's actually the final point of the inquiry committee. You have the final report, and they grow longer and longer now, the reports, you know, with copy-paste and internet and Wikipedia being available to make for fast-growing reports. I'm joking, of course, in terms of Wikipedia. Our boss is always saying, okay, the report is very long, let's say 1,200 pages, I think, in the case of our the underground Nazi scandal we had a couple of years ago. It was 1,200 pages, I think, and maybe out of this 1,200, 300 are from the opposition. So you have two parts. One part is by the majority, and the minority, it's also minority right. Everything is a minority right, up to the final report. So you have the 300 pages, or how many you want, that the minority can draft as they see fit. And our boss is always saying, well, forget about the 1,200 pages. Media only wants to read the minority report, because, of course, that's where the juice is. Of course, the majority doesn't accuse the government of anything. It's a boring part. So to come to the core of the question, if we understood you correctly.
Other parts of the minority?
Sorry?
Maybe there's a conflict between minorities.
Yes, that's an interesting point, but I think there is no right to sue. Like the minorities, I think they have the right, or at least it's parliamentary practice, they can publish even their own minority reports. So you know how it is with let's say, if it's a left opposition, the left always splits into whatever. It's the historic tragedy of the left. And so we had minority reports, I would say, sometimes. I think we had three different reports, because even the minority couldn't fully agree on certain results. But of course, it's a terrible outcome politically, because how can you achieve something if even the minority report is split into three? But I don't see any ground for suing your co-opposition members. Like there's nothing in the constitution, nothing in this orange law that would give you the right to do so. Well, there's a huge utility, if you ask me. Of course, if you work in such a committee, you write this 1,200 pages report and you joke nobody is going to read it, and oh my God, I mean, it's weeks and months of long evening work and all of it, but it's very, very important. I give you one example or two examples. We had really huge, embarrassing political finance scandals in Germany that I think the judge in question said Germany looks like Banana Republic. It's not a very PC remark to say something like Banana Republic, but it was the language of the 80s. We had coffers of cash exchanged on a Swiss parking space between industrial people and politicians. I mean, stuff really you would expect it, you know, like, let's not take a country from here, but you know, like in Uzbekistan, or you would expect it wherever, you know, like things like this. But it happened in Germany, and it happened across all major parties. It's the so-called Flick scandal from the 70s. We had the similar scandal with Chancellor Kohl. The interesting thing now is,
and the same with Siemens.
Yeah, yes. But wait, the interesting thing is, it was not criminal back then. There was simply a gap in legislation. So now who is doing the inquiry? The media can do it, but they have limited rights. The prosecutors could not do it. So you have actually parliamentary inquiry, a huge report, and out of this you have a legislative reform. And for decades to come, academia, media, they have a resource. There's a full account of what happened. And I'm using inquiry reports for my anti-corruption work, for example, even 50 years after. We had bribery scandals in parliament. It's very funny. As you might know, Germany is one of the few countries, aside of North Korea and Syria, which didn't sign this International Anti-Corruption Convention until about 2 years ago. Then we ratified it because bribery in parliament was not fully criminalized. We had prosecutors starting an investigation, it's really cute, investigating for 3 months a bribery scandal in parliament, collecting evidence, and then opening the criminal code. Oh my God, it's not even criminalized. You know, they were assuming it's criminalized, but it wasn't. So then again, an inquiry committee takes over. And it's full account. It was one scandal was in the 70s that the East German Stasi was actually bribing a West German lawmaker or two of them. And decades later, new evidence appears. And now you can connect the inquiry committee report with this new evidence appearing. So there's multiple ways actually how these reports come to use, and they're actually fascinating to read if ever anybody reads them.
Thank you very much. I'm very sorry to interrupt you at that hot moment. I think we close with a short question and contribution, a short one, because also our Polish colleague should have a chance to present her case. Albrecht, very briefly.
No, it was just to say that I agree, if I think I can read the mind of George, that the utility of minority reports, I can understand that for fact-finding. But in my country, a very important task of inquiry committees is also to make legislative proposals. And it has much more authority when there's a whole committee that makes that report, that those recommendations, than a minority.
Very short. There was another question there?
Yeah, okay. Thank you. About the minority opinion, I don't know. I was in the German case. The parliament vote this opinion or just publish?
The important part is that it's published, and they also vote on it, but it has no meaning, really. They say, okay, we take note. They say this, it's a resolution. We take note of the report. It doesn't really, in that sense, it doesn't mean much. But coming back actually to your colleague's remark, and it relates to yours, of course, the function of the inquiry committee is actually much, much earlier. It's about all the evidence. It's about the procedure. It's about the scandal. There's a famous saying in Germany, which is, once you set up the inquiry committee, the scandal is over. So the function of the committee is just to be there and have a preventive effect. Its effect is actually even before it's being set up. I worked in ministries, and our thinking always was, oh my God, if we will have an inquiry committee, so better let's do this or that. So there's a huge preventive effect of inquiry committees, at least in Germany.
Thanks. I think you could continue maybe during the city tour and sit together in one of these strange vehicles. Okay, now I have the pleasure to announce Mrs. Evelina Girach. Who will speak about something that already showed up in the speech of Mr. Kunja, the Polish case of Rubin case, and the floor is yours to close this session this day with something from Poland. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. At the beginning of my exposé, I would like to apologize for my English. It's my first exposé in this language. This exposé is comprised of three parts. Its first part highlights the legal framework of the report of the same investigative committee. The second part concerns the investigative committee of the Rubin affair. The third part analyzes the judgment of the European Court of Human Rights of 11 February 2016 concerning the case on Rubin versus Poland. To begin with, let us point out that the legal framework of report of investigative committee is not provided directly by the Constitution. Article 111, para 1 of the Constitution of the Republic of Poland allows the Sejm to create the so-called investigative committee. The Sejm may appoint an investigative committee to examine a particular matter. This rule is further developed by provisions of the Act on the Sejm Investigative Committee and of the standing orders of the Sejm of the Republic of Poland. According to Article 19A of the Act on the Sejm Investigative Committees, the committee shall draw up a report on its activity. The chairman of the committee shall prepare and present to the committee a draft of the committee position. Members of the committee may submit written proposal to amend the draft position. The investigative committee shall adopt its position by means of a resolution. The report may also contain dissenting opinions of deputies being members of the committee. A dissenting opinion shall contain a position different from that of the committee. According to Articles 136G of the Standing Orders of the Sejm, the committee presents a report on its activities to Marshal of the Sejm. The Marshal of the Sejm orders printing of the investigative committee report and its delivery to the deputies. At the sitting of the Sejm, the report of the investigative committee is presented by a deputy chosen from amongst its members, who impartially presents the committee position and the dissenting opinions contained in the report. In the course of consideration of the committee report by the Sejm, amendments shall not be proposed. The committee report shall not be subject to voting. According to Article 20 of the Act on Investigative Committee, in the event that the committee hasn't concluded its activity before the end of the term of office of the Sejm which appointed, the proceedings concluded by it shall cease on the day of the end of the term of office. But according to Article 21, if the committee has submitted a report on its activity to the Marshal of the Sejm and the Sejm has not considered it before the end of its term of office, it may be considered by the Sejm on the next term of office. The Act on Sejm Investigative Committees precise that the report of an investigative committee contains the committee position on the matter specified in the resolution establishing the committee. Therefore, it's a document containing a report of the work of the committee. The committee shall present to the Sejm the facts that it has established. It's important that the committee should take great care not to make any assessments of a criminal legal nature. Under this provision, Sejm established 9 investigative committees. The last one is still working. Other committees have adopted their reports. On 2 cases, the reports were considered by the Sejm on the next term of office. The first investigative committee was established in the wake of the so-called Rubin affair. In December 22, the largest Polish newspaper, Gazeta Wyborcza, revealed that its publisher, Agora, had been approached by the film producer, Lech Rubin, with a proposal to introduce changes to draft law and electronic media favorable to Agora in exchange to $70.5 million. newspapers' revelations resulted in public pressure to seek accountability. Consequently, on 10th January 2003, the Sejm created an investigative committee, commonly known as the Investigative Committee on the Rubin Affair. In December 22, the public prosecutor for Warsaw launched a criminal investigation. On completion of the criminal investigation, Mr. Rubin was convicted by the first instance court. The work of the investigative committee was carried out alongside the criminal proceedings against Mr. Rubin and gave rise to extensive media comment. The committee interviewed sources of witness, including Prime Minister and several other officials. The same committee's proceedings were broadcast live and on national television and radio. Okay. Also, the publications of the committee's final report was controversial. With a majority vote, committee adopted a report without prior discussion that came to the same conclusions as the criminal court, according to which Mr. Rubin had been acting completely on his own. However, a dissenting minority, including the committee chairman, refused to back the report and began to compile a minority report. In September 2004, the Sejm unexpectedly voted to accept the minority report, which named five high-ranking state officials alleged to have been guilty of corruption in connection with the legislative procedure for the amendment of the Broadcasting Act, including Prime Minister, the Deputy Minister of Culture, the head of the National Public Television Broadcaster, and Prime Minister's chief of the cabinet. Mr. Rubin was mentioned in the report as the agent of the above mentioned officials. On 1st February 2006, Mr. Lech Rubin lodged the application to the European Court of Human Rights. And he complained that he had been imprisoned despite his state or health and that he had not received appropriate treatment in the prison environment. And he had not had a fair trial, and this is right to be presumed innocent had been branched. The court concluded that there had been no violation of articles of the convention. The judgment, the court took the view that even though the report had described the applicant as the agent of the individuals in question, it had not accused him directly or cast any judgment of his conduct. The report's conclusions had not included any findings as to whether criminal proceedings should be brought against Mr. Rubin or any comment on his possible criminal liability for complicity in bribery. Likewise, the Commission's report had made no reference to the criminal proceedings brought against Mr. Rubin. In the court's view, it was apparent that even though the facts being investigated by the Parliamentary Commission had been the same and those being examined in the criminal proceedings against Mr. Rubin, the aims underlying the two sets of proceedings had been different. The court noted that cooperation between the Commission and the judicial authorities conducting the criminal proceeding was permitted, and even the certain circumstances required by domestic law, provided that it complied with the applicable domestic legal framework. And the exchanges between the Parliamentary Commission and the criminal authorities had led to the Commission to bring the information it had gathered to the attention of the Public Prosecutor's Office and the courts. I think you are wondering how the Sejm has reacted to this judgment. It wasn't a subject of analysis of or discussion between deputies and between constitutional doctrine. Also, Polish media were not especially interested in it. Perhaps it is related to the fact that almost all committees had ended their work before the judgment was given. It is worth to add that proceedings of most committees were less controversial and were not so extensive commented by the media. The committee's proceedings usually were broadcast live on national media, although their meetings were public. Thank you very much for your attention. I'm sorry for my English.
Thank you very much, Evelina. And so the slot is open for questions, and I think Turkey would like to know or to say something. Thank you.
Halit Tunçkaşık from Turkey. I'd like to ask a question about the report. If this report, the shape of the report, you talked about the minority report, but I couldn't understand if there is a separate report without the main report. Because in Turkey, for example, the committee prepared one report, and in this report, the opposition members might declare their opinion. But if in your country there is a separate report of the minority?
One moment, please. No, it is one report. Now, the act of the same investigative committee provides that the chairman of the committee prepare one report, but it was some years ago, and the legal basis was changed. So in this case, the case of Rubin affair, the legal basis deputies, I don't know how it explained. There wasn't any legal basis for the activity of the deputies. It was practice only. Now we have one report.
Thank you. Is there another Alberic, Belgium?
Can you tell us if Parliament was involved in the defense of the Polish position for the court in Strasbourg? The Parliament as institution, was it involved in defending the Polish position or not?
I think no.
What is your opinion about the decision of the European Court?
I think that judgment is, I don't know how to say, it's correct. I think that a report of the same investigative committee and its goal is quite different than a criminal proceedings. So it shouldn't... make any influence for the criminal proceedings.
Maybe I would allow one last question before we close the session today and go for our social event. So, Mr. Cunha would have a last word.
Speak. Yeah.
Yes.
Sorry. Now, só para dizer que o processo junto do Tribunal Europeu dos Direitos do Homem são processos contra os Estados. Portanto, digamos que o réu nesses processos são sempre os Estados. Aqui era um processo contra a Polónia, portanto não era um processo contra o Parlamento da Polónia, embora eu presumo que os agentes do Estado polaco, na sua defesa perante o Tribunal, tenham falado, obviamente, com o Parlamento e com os responsáveis pelo Parlamento para organizar a defesa. Outra coisa só que queria dizer é que, em facto, para além das questões da prisão do Sr. Rivin, que não são aqui especialmente interessantes, o que é que é interessante são as duas questões do relacionamento das comissões de inquérito com os processos judiciais. Uma das queixas era, como aqui foi explicado, ele queixava-se de que todo o processo na comissão de inquérito tinha infringido a sua presunção de inocência e, por outro lado, que isso tinha contaminado o processo judicial e que ele tinha sido condenado no processo judicial por causa e muito por influência todo o trabalho da comissão de inquérito. Ora, o tribunal negou estas duas queixas. Mas não deixa de ser interessante que, quanto à primeira, os 7 juízes votaram 4 a favor, 3 contra. Ou seja, a deliberação não foi pacífica, o que só vem provar que estas questões relacionadas com inquéritos parlamentares, direitos fundamentais e processos judiciais não são questões simples e não são matérias controversas apenas em Portugal. Quanto à segunda queixa, da tal contaminação do processo judicial, em que o senhor se queixava de não ter tido um processo judicial equitativo, o tribunal aqui já foi unânime em declarar que não concluíra por qualquer contaminação do processo judicial pelos trabalhos do inquérito parlamentar. Portanto, era só esta observação que queria fazer. Entretanto, o senhor acho que já faleceu precisamente mais ou menos na altura em que o tribunal deliberou, em 2016, o que me parece que o tribunal deve-se ter apressado ao fim de 10 anos, porque a queixa era de 2006 e se calhar soube que o senhor estava a falecer e então decidiu acabar com o processo e ver a deliberação, senão se calhar ainda estávamos à espera neste momento da deliberação.
We close the session for today. And now I think Dalila has a lot of practical information for us how it will go on.
Not a lot. We have a small break until we leave. We will only leave. We will leave from the door of this building at around 6 o'clock. So you have a small break for refreshment and for smoking a cigarette if you need to.